that Alaska can kill a person. I mean, everything from falling overboard, you know, you've got 10 to 20 minutes to live in that icy cold water before hypothermia sets in. A lot of people misjudge distance because the air is so pure and there's no industry up there in the towns. So there's no particles. There's no pollution in the air whatsoever. And I had to learn to double or triple the distance that my eye was telling my brain for actual distance. Wow. Because you'd be out in an outboard, you know, you'd be in a dory and you'd have half a tank of gas and you go, oh man, it's blowing 80 out of the southeast. I think I can make it to that shore. It, you know, it looks like it's probably 20 minutes away. Well, 2 hours later, you're not even halfway there and you run out of gas.
Oh man.
And be swept out to sea. So you got to double or triple in that crystal clear air. Everything looks so much closer in distance than what it really is. So, I mean, I had nothing on my resume. I was 40,000 leagues in over my head. Unlike the TV show Survivor, there was nobody else on that island to vote you off and send you home.
Right, no camera crew.
Yeah, so it literally was a crash course. And all of this innate instinctual knowledge, and Emerson called it the oversoul. It's almost like a genetic coding that all this knowledge that I didn't even know that I knew was coming to the surface to keep myself alive.
So like your instincts.
Yeah, and if we have 9 lives like a cat, I probably have 1.5 left. Because I should have died in Alaska at least 5 times.
Wow, I would imagine being in the wilderness like that, any minor injury is actually quite major, right?
Well, you know, one morning I get up and you sleep high in your cabin. Everybody sleeps in a loft. That way you catch the heat from your wood stove as it rises to the ceiling. And in the Inside Passage, it's maritime. It's pretty mild. The Japanese current comes by. So rarely does it go sub-zero where I was. But about 2 weeks out of every winter, and we experienced it in the lower 48 last winter especially, the freezer door opens and the cold freeze comes across Canada. And it will hit the Inside Passage in the coastal area, British Columbia and Alaska, for maybe 2 weeks every winter where it can go zero and below. So sure enough, the temperature was dropping. You want to load up your wood stove with green wood, wood that has some moisture to it so it burns very slow through the night. You wake up 6-7 hours later in the morning, you've got a glowing bed of embers in your airtight wood stove, throw in a few new chunks of wood, and you stay warm, unbroken that way, you know, just by keeping the wood going. Well, like an idiot, I loaded up the wood stove, but the wood was too green. And all the old timers up there, when I first got there, they said, hey kid, you got to sleep with a thermometer inside your house. And I go, why? And they said, just do it. So I put the thermometer on the bedroom wall. It was February, my first winter, the Arctic Express hit, temperatures dropping, went to bed, but I loaded the airtight, the wood was too green. About 2:30 in the morning, the fire died. And I was in a sleeping bag rated to 0 degrees, but I was so cold and my teeth were chattering. So I grabbed the flashlight and looked at the thermometer on the bedroom wall. It was 7 degrees below zero and falling. You could actually see red mercury line starting to drop. So, I mean, life or death inside your house. You got to put it in gear. I scrambled down the loft ladder. And like an idiot, I panicked. I was so cold. In the darkness over in the corner of the cabin, I grabbed a hatchet and I'm flailing away trying to chop this cedar kindling to get a new fire kicked up. I should have taken 2 minutes to light the kerosene lamps to see by.
Right.
But in the darkness, that the axe hit a knot in the wood, bounced off the log, and sliced deep into the web of my left thumb.
Wow.
And it wasn't dribbling out. It was arcing like 3 feet. And then your blood pressure goes up, the blood shooting even more. And I was so stupid when I first went up there, I didn't even have a first aid kit. So long story short, I had to put 3 stitches into my own hand.
Wow, that sounds pretty intense. So How did you learn all these skills? Was it something you were kind of dropped into and kind of had to figure out some for yourself, figure out some from the, you know, from the Indians that you were with? Or how did you come across these skills?
Well, after my first winter, when I survived out there, and the Indians came by when they first met me, and I hadn't seen a human being for 2.5 months. And it's the weirdest thing. Your tongue, your power of speech is like any other muscle. If you don't exercise it every day, it withers away. So right. I literally, that first winter was so in over my head, I should have mumbled out loud. I should have sang just to keep my speech alive.
Just talk to yourself, wow. Something.
Yeah, it's actually something I've never considered.
I was so scared, and 10 times a day I thought I would die, and it was all inward. I wasn't putting out very much. And when the natives showed up with the break in the storms, I opened the door, I jumped on the stump porch, so excited to see people. I opened my mouth, you know, brain fired to signal my tongue to say, hi, would you like to come in for a cup of coffee? What came out of my mouth, I sounded like, like a car. I mean, you know, if you break your arm and you have it in a cast for 2 months, your broken arm is withered. You know, it's half the size of your exercise arm.
Right. You got to build it back up.
Yeah. So who would think, you know, your tongue, power of speech, same way. Natives came in. They thought I was drunk at 10 o'clock in the morning. And Larry Joseph said, you white people are all the same. You have a head full of knowledge. Oh, you know all the facts. Then he pointed to his heart. He said, you have no wisdom. You're going to end up burning those books. I had brought a bunch of books to read in the long winter nights. He said, you're going to burn those books in your wood stove to keep yourself alive. They marched out of the door. He turned and looked over his right shoulder, and his parting words were, I'll be by in the spring to collect your bones.
Wow.
So that was a welcoming. that was a chamber of commerce, and there was no welcome neighbor fruit basket, you know?
Wow. Doesn't sound encouraging.
Yeah,
for sure.
For this guy who's out here drunk at 10 in the morning, I guess not.
Yeah, and I could see them looking at each other like, we could take this island back without even trying.
Yeah.
And later they told me, the native said, we decided to leave you out there. Let nature ask the questions. And if you came up with the answers on your own, then maybe you're supposed to be here.
And it seems like you did come up with those.
I passed that test and I survived that first winter. Oh my God. They opened up an encyclopedia set full of knowledge.
Really?
And these natives in Canada and further north in Alaska, they've never been conquered by the white man. Mm-hmm. So they've never been thrown away on useless reservations. They have lived there continuously for at least 10,000 years. And they have their pride and heritage intact. And they know that place better than the back of their hand.
Oh, I'm sure. I also want to get into, you know, this was in your book, and this is really what kind of drew us to you the most. I want you to relive that moment to when you touched a killer whale, and I just want to know what that was like.
Probably one of the most magical experiences in my life. And it just was a random day. I mean, you wake up and, you know, I did the chores, chopped the wood, but I had been housebound, you know, with a bit of cabin fever because another storm rolled in for about 10 days without stopping, and the rain would hit the windows like BB shot, and The wind would shake the walls of the house. Finally, there was a little patch of blue and the ocean calmed down, so I needed exercise. And I've always been a runner my whole life, but there aren't a lot of trails on that little island. So I would get my exercise sort of by hiking with my arms in the kayak or in a little skiff that I had. So I decided to head out in the skiff. And the body of water right in front of the island is called Blackfish Sound. And the native's nickname for the killer whales is the blackfish.
Right.
Because their coloration is predominantly black. So I'm rowing out there, and all of a sudden, about 50 yards straight ahead of me, I heard the explosion of 3 breaths. And when they exhale, that vapor and the force, the mist can go up about 10 feet. So there's no mistaking that sound. And I swiveled around because when you're rowing a skiff, you know, your back is to the bow. And I pulled in the oars. I turned around on the seat. The big bull and the male dorsal fin is 6 feet tall, from the back to the up to the taper tip.
Wow.
And the big bull or the male dove. And it just seems like it takes about 2 minutes for that submarine tower, you know, that dorsal fin to knife all the way under and disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a smaller orca or killer whale. And then there was a female. The female fin is shorter and it's more rounded, curved toward the back. So the young killer whale disappeared with the male, the big bull, but the female was closest. And she kind of lifted her head before she dove. They have big blue eyes, about as big as your two fists if you put them together. And she took a visual on my boat, even though they knew exactly where I was with their sonar, which is an amazing ability. They can see the sound. But she took a visual on me and then dove. And for some reason, I knew she was coming close, sort of drawing a bead. And, you know, to this day, I don't know if it took 2 minutes or 2 hours. It was like my heart was beating in my ears. It was one of those moments where you're waiting and this time-space continuum just sort of, you know, melted away. And sure enough, she came up right alongside the skiff, and right up at the bow, she exhaled. And I was sort of baptized in that mist and vapor. And I don't know why I did this, but I wanted to make contact. It was as if, you know, an alien had landed on Earth or in the ocean. I put out my hand. By this time, she was totally alongside the boat. And I reached out my hand and I touched her right behind the dorsal fin. And, you know, a lot of people might think, oh, they probably feel like a car tire, you know, sort of rough skin. But they're so aerodynamic. They can swim at, you know, like 20 miles an hour, 25 miles going through that ocean, as big as they are. And that skin was just like silk. And when I made contact with her, she didn't, you know, go to the side or dive below my hand. I remember her sort of pressing up against it. And the word whale is actually a Norwegian word meaning wheel. And that's sort of the motion they do when they come up to the surface.
Right.
So she wheeled against my hand all the way down to her tail flukes. And as my hand was sliding down her back, silky smooth, her muscles gave a shudder as if you and I would shake hands. It was as if, okay, you've touched me, I'm touching you back. And it took me, I don't know, maybe an hour to row out to that position. And the next thing I knew is if it was a minute later, I was back inside the cabin. It's like that contact shifted me into just a whole nother perspective. And to this day, my fingertips on that right hand, they tingle with that energy that was exchanged.
Right. So wow. A lot of people, if they were to think about coming in contact with the killer whale, they would just freak at the thought of it. But it sounds like it was just like this natural thing, like it was really calm. Were you scared, nervous at all?
Strangely not, because, I mean, she could have tipped my boat over without even trying. You know, she was that close. But I had been around them enough to know, I mean, they're the top predator in the ocean. They're found in all seven seas. Other than human beings, killer whales are the most widespread mammal on Earth. And, you know, we should really call this planet Planet Ocean, because 71% of the planet is covered with salt water.
Right.
So it's really falsely named. It's Planet Ocean instead of Earth, and the Pacific Ocean alone is larger than all the land continents combined. So they rule the roost, if you really think about it, of our planet being the dominant species in the liquid world. And I had seen them with their tails bat seals and sea lions up into the air 20 to 30 feet like a cat playing with a mouse. To stun them before they would eat them. And, you know, I had seen them herd in on salmon and with blood, and I'd been in my kayak when they were feeding on herring, and I was right in the middle of the feeding frenzy, so much so that I'd go home covered in and blood and fish confetti. The silver scales were stuck all over me. And I had my own dinner. The herring had to escape the killer whales. I was so close in the feeding pod that the herring would jump in the air and they would land in my open cockpit of the kayak.
Right.
And these herring, about 8 inches long, killer whales love them because we call them fat packets. They're loaded with fat and oil. And they would swim around for a few hours in the bilge water in my kayak. So I had my dinner when I'd go home. So I had seen how, quote, vicious, or, but that's a judgmental word. I had seen how efficient they were as predators.
Right. And
but yet all of that was forgotten when that female came alongside the skiff, because the vibe was totally different. She approached me with a gentleness and a curiosity.
Right, and something seems very calming and just interesting about something that has the capacity to kill you in an instant, but yet just slowly, you know, wheels by you.
And that's what the adrenaline rush was, you know, just about every day, especially in the spring and summer when they were out there in Blackfish Sound and I'd head out in the kayak. I mean, it definitely got your heart going as you were paddling up to the pod.
Yeah, it almost seems like in nature, intelligence recognizes intelligence. I mean, I hear that kind of often, that whales and dolphins, these top predators of the ocean, the super intelligent ones anyway, kind of are almost, I would say, interested in humans, at least curious. But one thing I kind of wanted to touch on is I've heard that orcas will like stun a seal or any other prey animal and let their calves practice hunting on it. Did you ever witness that?
Yeah, and I mean, they take their babies to school, I mean, just like we would. Only you might call it homeschooling, because both the, you know, the bulls and the mothers, but it's a matriarchal society, so it's mainly the mothers and the grandmothers that school the young ones and, you know, teach them how to hunt. And there's two species of killer whales, and what's really fascinating, there's the local whales that kind of have a home turf. And I wouldn't say that they're pacifists, but they're happy to eat mainly salmon and not so many marine mammals. And the second species, and these guys, you might say, are the bullies of the killer whale world. And they're what we call transients. They're a man without a country. They don't have a home turf or a locale that they live in. They simply roam up and down the west coast of North America. Their range, they've been seen all the way down in Mexico, Baja, off the deep canyon of Monterey, where they try to drown the baby humpback whales that are coming north into migration and eat them. And they have a swagger about them. And they run silent, run deep. They're very quiet. They really use their sonar. Mm-hmm. And I've actually seen them approach a beach where seals are kind of letting down their guard and sunbathing in a warm spring day. And they will just roll inside of a wave that's breaking on the shore. And they will just snatch that seal off the beach as if it's a party favor off of a tray. And they actually teach their young ones to do that, to time the wave so they can use the water momentum to roll up and then use the vacuum in the pull of the wave going out. It's very tricky so that they don't get stranded.
Yes, it seems like kind of a risky, difficult thing to do, especially for something vulnerable like a baby orca.
And every once in a while, you know, one will misjudge and there'll be a stranding. And if human beings are around, of course, they try to... because the whale or the killer whale can actually crush itself with its own weight. So, you know, people will try to float it back, and once in a while they're successful.
So what's one thing, if you could go back in time, what's one thing you could tell your younger self before heading out into the wilderness? What's kind of the one thing you needed to know? It's a hard question, I know.
I would be so scared. I mean, from what I knew, and, you know, going through that whole process, there's that saying that ignorance is bliss. But I would just tell myself before I went there. But then, you know, you can't be more prepared. It's almost like you have to drop into a situation with what you know at the time. And by not knowing anything, each day was a complete year of compressed new experiences. If I had gone there as an Eagle Scout and, you know, I had camped every weekend and it just was an intensification of what I knew before, I don't think my growth would have been as accelerated or maybe as meaningful by going there as a total neophyte.
And that was our interview. Thank you so much, Michael, for sitting down with us.
We really hope you've enjoyed it, and we really appreciate Michael for giving us some of his time.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's been an absolute honor to be on your show.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and jump right into our UTM segment. What you got, Clint?
Today we're going to do the sea turtle.
10 times magnified.
They can live to be 80 to 100 years old.
Some species can stay underwater for 5 hours.
Their heart rate and metabolism is slowed to conserve energy.
When surfacing to breathe, a sea turtle can quickly refill its lungs in a single explosive exhalation and a rapid inhalation.
Sand temperature at nesting beaches define the sex of a sea turtle while developing in the egg, and higher temperatures make more females.
So, with temperatures rising, could this produce too many females and threaten their existence?
Yes. Yes, it could. But I remain confident in their ability to adapt.
When baby turtles hatch, they all hatch at the same time.
This way, when they make a run for the ocean, a greater number of babies will survive the assault by predators.
It seems so calculated.
Well, it is. As soon as they develop enough in the egg, they chirp back and forth, working as a team to hatch at the same time so they can sprint.
Have you ever had sea turtle soup?
I'll pretend you didn't say that.
100 times magnified.
The leatherback sea turtle hangs out in cold northern waters in the summer, eating fish.
But then it gets way too cold, so they head back south.
Now, how do they know where to go?
Well, the Journal of Experimental Marine Biology and Ecology found that sea turtles have a super thin pink spot on top of their head. It's so thin that sunlight streams through the pink spot and hits the pineal gland in the brain, telling them the season is going to change and they need to head down south.
So it's like a skylight.
Or a third eye.
I'd like a third eye.
I'd like a skylight. And that's our episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please contact us. Go to utmpodcast.com for all the links.
And make sure you click on the show notes tab because you will find all of Michael Modulesky's information there.
And look for the tab that says be a part of the show, where you can lend us your voice so that we can use it in a future episode.
And if you are listening to this on iTunes, please rate us. That would mean a lot. And honestly, rate us. Thanks. Oh. And next episode is about camouflage. You're not going to want to miss it. Oh, got him.